back, I think, for episode 332. Joe, how you doing?
I'm just fine, Tim. How are you?
Very well, thanks for asking. Well, this week we kind of I think at the end of the show touched on this because I think the day before it was announced that the Chilean American journalist, YouTuber, life coach Gonzalo Lira had passed away in captivity in Ukraine. He went by the name, I think, Coach Red Pill. I used to watch some of his videos for a couple of years now because he was always a very he was a talented speaker. He had a certain approach to things. He was very good at making videos, and so they were very engaging, or not engaging, I guess engaging, just interesting because you wouldn't engage, you'd watch it. It was passive, but he'd give various pieces of advice. He got more political as events unfolded. But apparently, he was an American expat or Chilean expat living in Ukraine. Reports are that he had taken a wife and had children there. But then he got in trouble recently because he, after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, he started, I guess, commenting on that and I guess providing a information that was that undermined the official narrative of evil Putin invading Ukraine and undermining the NATO Anglo-American Zio, I guess, narrative. And he got himself in trouble with the I guess police there, Zelensky's police. He was arrested, detained, then released, then arrested again, and then told his passport was taken and he told not to leave the country. And then last summer, it was reported that he'd been arrested trying to leave the country. I think he escaped to Hungary. And then he was imprisoned and then he was incommunicado for a while. His father had talked about it. He didn't get to, apparently he wasn't given access to a lawyer or regular access to a lawyer. Reports are that he was tortured while in prison. In fact, he said that the first time he was detained, he was beaten up, intimidated. And then we got word last week, you told me, and then I obviously heard it from other sources that he had died from a pneumonia in prison, obviously from neglect. He'd only been taken to the hospital, I think, a couple of weeks before. And so he died in captivity. He was a political prisoner. What was most disturbing about it was the reaction of the United States government to this. He was a U.S. citizen, of course, living in a foreign country who really wasn't guilty of any particular crime, although they made it illegal to criticize the government. But nevertheless, the U.S. government has forked over $100 billion to support the Zelensky regime and told him that we're fighting for democracy. And we assume one of the attributes of democracy is the right to criticize your government or the government you're living under. But nevertheless, he was a foreigner. And at the very least, you would think if the government had trouble with him, they wouldn't arrest him and torture him to death and leave him to die, or they would just deport him, expel him. And you think the United States embassy there, United States State Department, would intervene on his behalf. Now, considering the US government is pretty much paying the entire payroll of the Zelensky regime, they have a lot of leverage there. But nevertheless, the Biden administration chose to sit back and do nothing. Our U.S. government did nothing for him. And this is telling because this isn't something the U.S. government would do in the past. I've been talking to a few people about this. Some people say, "Well, you play stupid games, win stupid prizes." They say, "Well, no, what they're really—that's a cope. What they're—we're not willing to accept it. With this singular event or story kind of exposes this. The United States has passed a cultural and political Rubicon, where now we have political litmus tests for representation with the government. In the past, there's sort of a bureaucracy, a perfunctory process that all Americans could appeal to if they were abroad and get some sort of service from the government. It appears the Biden administration and the State Department had a vendetta against Gonzalo Lira because he had exposed the corruption there. And this is particularly interesting because, of course, the Biden administration, his family, in fact, I the large a portion of the entire Washington establishment, I think, is connected to corruption in Ukraine. So when you have a singular individual, a person pointing out the corruption of the war there that is backed by the United States and how it's involving certain powerful people, of course, we've known the Biden, Hunter Biden story, I was tied in Ukraine corruption. There are literally millions of dollars have changed hands that they might have had an interest in having him, I guess, killed, or not caring that he's being killed. What's also telling is another incident that last summer, the U.S. government stirred up a moral panic over a semi-pro pot-smoking, American-hating basketball player, a black lesbian. So she rates much higher than Coach Red Pill, because Coach Red Pill at least appeared to be a white American. Now, Brittany Griner wouldn't stand for the national anthem. She claimed to dislike her country as racist. And of course, she was a lesbian. So in many respects, she supports the regime. The American regime doesn't like America. The American regime is anti-American. So that's why Brittany Griner got so much attention. There's also other political prisoners abroad. There was Whelan is his name. He was a U.S. Marine. He's being held in Russia as a spy, alleged spy. He may or may not be a spy, but it's interesting. U.S. government actually arranged a prisoner exchange to get Brittany Griner released. I think they gave up Victor Boot, who was a notorious arms dealer, to get this basketball player. She was arrested for smuggling pot into Russia, which is a violation of Russian law. This guy Whelan is accused of being a spy. They have done nothing for him, but they got out this black lesbian semi-pro basketball player. So that's particularly enraging. The government, the entire government in Ukraine is a proxy of United States, NATO. It is entirely dependent on the U.S. government for its continued existence. Yet the government did nothing to help Gonzalo Lira. So what say you?
Well, I was asked, like, when Gonzalo was incarcerated, you know, my opinion, and I said he's never going to get out; he'll die there. And I had that opinion because Gonzalo has, you know, a special relationship to the independent media, and they are the Biden administration et al., basically the Judeo-Masonic global conspiracy, are creating instructions to the independent media. They're trying to control it by these examples. And Gonzalo is basically, he's just a parallel to the 1/6 individuals who've been incarcerated. What is being expressed are conditioned, the psychological implication of Gonzalo's incarceration and death is that if you speak out, if you are an independent media personality and you speak out, then you aren't covered any longer by what we think of as civil rights. In fact, you're very likely, if you're ever incarcerated, to simply be left there and die. And the purpose is just to shut us up, you know. So when Gonzalo was incarcerated, it was obvious the reason that he was imprisoned was to shut him up, right? He was making very specific criticisms about how the war was being waged and about the number of Ukrainians that were dying and what would happen to the country if the war went on. Basically, he was completely accurate in all of his assertions. I mean, you get to the situation we have today. What was he wrong about? So he was correct. And he was putting that information into the independent media. He was part of the growing kind of counter understanding of reality that the independent media represents. And so he was not just incarcerated, but then he was denied all rights. The U.S. government never interceded in any way for him, right? They could have got him out in a heartbeat. But he was left to die publicly as a message to the independent media. And at the same time, they were, of course, taking care of the black lesbian American-hating basketball player. Both of these are psychological messages, right, of how the ruling class looks at us and how we have to behave if we want any rights. You know, if you're in the camp that's promoting anti-Americanism, lesbianism, and DEI, you get some assistance. if you're trying to tell the truth about the genocide in Ukraine, forget it. You're going to be used as an example of what we do to people who, you know, have those beliefs, and specifically people who try to inform others about the reality that the Ukrainians are experiencing.
Yes. A similar case would be Julian Assange.
Yeah.
The WikiLeaks guy who started WikiLeaks. And his organization released information about the corruption of the U.S. government, Hillary Clinton. I believe, wasn't it Seth Rich's thumb drive that was released to WikiLeaks?
Yeah.
Okay, and so, of course, Seth Rich was shot dead on a street in a robbery where nothing was taken. I think Mike Pompeo, the former director of the CIA, has called for his death. And now Julian Assange is not a U.S. citizen, yet he's being tried for betraying the U.S. government. So I don't quite understand that. Now, his organization apparently received information. Of course, he's a journalist, and he's no different than, say, the New York Times or the Washington Post publishing the Pentagon Papers. There was a time when people like, Danny Ellsberg were celebrated. In fact, he was a hero. He was the most dangerous man in America. Henry Kissinger supposedly said that he was. But he was celebrated and became a celebrity. He just passed away last year. And because the Pentagon Papers, in my opinion, was a limited hangout. So he had served a purpose. But nevertheless, there was a time, at least publicly, these people were celebrated. Same with Bradley Manning, when he released, I think, two WikiLeaks, the information, the video of U.S. troops, committing war crimes in Iraq. Again, providing information to the American public about the true nature of what their government is doing abroad, apparently is considered treasonous, even though that's, you would think that's essential. That's why there are laws supposed to be protecting whistleblowers, but they're simply going unenforced or not followed anymore. And the media doesn't back them up anymore in any of this. Another case, you mentioned the January 6th. You're saying they have a similar plight to Gonzalo Lira. Many of them have been abused, left to languish in prison, their families impoverished, people who are dying for lack of medical care, cancer patients, things like that. That's what's going on. And you have federal judges letting prosecutors drag out the process with their, basically overcharging, then dragging out the legal process where they're being denied a speedy, fair trial. Kangaroo courts. It's very similar. Domestically, another instance or a case of this would be Derek Chauvin, the police officer charged and eventually convicted for the unintentional and simultaneously intentional killing of George Floyd. Literally, he got charged for both manslaughter and murder simultaneously. This served a political purpose. Again, this is part of that demoralization that you're talking about, the summer of George Floyd 2020, the Black Lives Matter, Antifa riots. And someone like Derek Chauvin was simply along with the other two officers, were sacrificed for that. And because that's being exposed now with this documentary, The Fall of Minneapolis, talking about just how corrupt the criminal justice system has become to railroad people for political reasons. This isn't something, when you're saying, some people said that the Biden administration didn't do anything because they want to be able to do this to Americans domestically. Well, they already are doing it. It's just, it's just another example of demoralization. And to me, again, this symbolizes sort of a passing of the Rubicon, where the government now is just overtly or obviously just simply failing to perform its basic duties, which is one thing that the State Department is supposed to do instead of foment wars, one thing that a U.S. embassy is supposed to do in a foreign country is not be a staging ground for a color revolution to emanate or to undermine the host country's culture to cultural subversion and degeneracy. It's not there to celebrate sodomy. It's there to protect the interest of U.S. citizens that may happen to be in the country and to protect their rights and to see to it that they get due process. If they don't, to press those interests to that government. And the U.S. Embassy did not do that. Of course, we all know what the U.S. Embassy in Ukraine has been used for. Victoria Nuland used it to stage a color revolution. And the reason why that Gonzalo Lira was left to die in prison is because he exposed the corruption of Victoria Nuland et al. And so that's what Americans should take to heart in this. And really, this really should be a much bigger scandal than it is. Again, if you look at how many times the CNN or the Washington Post, New York Times mentioned the name Brittany Griner, And how many times have they mentioned the name Gonzalo Lira? And that tells you, that says it all.
Yeah, I mean, he's to the extent that anyone is aware of him, it's simply the independent media. And what we know is that he was basically incarcerated and given no civil rights, and then was, you know, murdered in a sense in prison. I mean, the lesson is to European Americans is that, you know, get used to living in a world without a Bill of Rights. You know?
Yeah. The odd thing is why did he stay? Did he have a, did he want to be a martyr? I mean, I doubt he wanted to die of pneumonia in a dingy Ukrainian hospital, underserved Ukrainian hospital.
He's a very strange guy.
Yes.
I've looked into him a little bit, and I he makes no sense to me.
Because he could have done those videos from anywhere.
Yeah.
His analysis wasn't like he had to be there. I mean, he could have gone to Hungary or gone to the United States and made the same video.
Of course. And you know me, I always think the worst. So I wouldn't be surprised if the whole thing was just a theatrical production to create a martyr in a sense of, you know, that can be given to the independent media to demoralize us. I mean, he surely didn't need to be in the Ukraine. That was ridiculous. And he should have known that the Zelensky regime was dictatorial and dangerous. And so what is the point? I mean, was he getting information that he couldn't get otherwise? I didn't see any of this. I read and listened to some of his information about the Ukrainian war, and it was pretty much the standard, you know, independent media understanding of it. So in any case, you know, I don't want to speak ill of the dead, and particularly ones that are, you know, being treated in this way. So I all I can say is that his death is being used as a psychological operation, and the last thing in the world that anyone in the independent media should take to heart about this is discouragement. It should be exactly the opposite. You know, we should be outraged and made less afraid, not more, because you know, when the controlling elite reveals themselves like this, the right thing to do is to become more energized and more focused on getting the information out. And they're going to hit us with, you know, psychological operation at one after another. But as long as we're aware of them and aware of their purpose, we should be able to, you know, not be affected and continue about our business.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And of course, as the consequences of the Ukrainian war become more obvious, Ukraine-Russian war, apparently continued instability in Germany, the Alternative for Germany party is apparently gaining ground, and so much so that the government is on the verge of declaring them illegal.
Right, which is a great sign.
There's our democracy. There's your democracy in Germany.
Right. But this is what we have to do. We just have to, you know, continue to drive forward, and they will declare this illegal and that illegal and punish this leader and execute that leader. So what? That's just the price of admission. We just have to keep growing in strength and keep organizing, and eventually we can, you know, find a way to topple these regimes, because they don't represent, you know, 5% of the people. And they are just kept in check, kept in power by our intimidation, basically. So we have to just keep, you know, bringing an end to that, and you know, we will find a way to bring democracy to these countries.
You saw the thing I sent you about the Hill, about talking about Germany. The Alternative for Germany party is being condemned for being fascist, because they've said that Germany should be for Germans.
Yeah,
primarily Germans. And they're saying, well, that's, you know, that you're excluding all of humanity. Well, that's what's the point of having a country if you don't exclude the other people? It's the point of having borders. But this is construed as being, and then it's been construed as being anti-Semitic. So if you're, okay, so we have a situation where supposedly Jewish organizations are the driving force behind mass immigration and the Great Replacement. And if you're against mass immigration and the Great Replacement, it's considered being anti-Semitic. Therefore, it's illegal to be against mass immigration and the Great Replacement.
Except in Israel, where they are completely you know, we'll execute anyone who tries to come into the country who isn't part of the guild and race. Yeah. So it's a little contradictory, isn't it?
Yeah, it is something. You saw the thing from the Hill. They're celebrating, I guess, think the increasing diversity and the decline of white people in America. And the one guy said that as America becomes more diverse, other cultures and ways of life and looking at things become more important to the culture, and also have political implications. So, well, the definition of genocide is nothing. I mean, doing away, replacing a native population through illegal means and overwhelming them, through mass immigration to overwhelm and do away with the native culture and the way of doing things is the definition of genocide, I think.
Well, yeah, I was fascinated by the article and particularly the phrase that they said that these multicultural entities that are coming into the country will have a deep understanding of their cultural identity, right?
Yes.
And now, so all of them, the Mesopotamians and whoever else, moving on in, they are encouraged to have this deep understanding of the cultural identity, and the, indigenous culture just has to give way. But the question arises is, well, do Europeans, are we allowed to have a deep understanding of our cultural identity?
Yeah.
How does that function politically? I mean, we're the majority, and they are these new ethnicities are being promoted and being advocated to have this deep understanding. Well, what about tit for tat here? I mean, can we talk about our cultural identity?
Well, the thing is this cultural change, just the demographic change, ethnic change of America, the makeup of America, is being done through illegal means, meaning the non-enforcement or violation of current law. So it's illegitimate, it's illegal to begin with. It isn't like this the weather, it just happened. It's being carried out through a treasonous federal government and treasonous government officials, and also various NGOs and foundations that are spearheading this. So that's what's happening. That's why it's happening. But yeah, the guy, it was director of Multicultural Insights at Collage Group, a great name. He told The Hill, the growth in multicultural populations in the United States means these segments wield immense influence. Interesting. Their desire for diverse perspectives and deep understanding of their cultural identity of brands and organizations will be ever more critical in the future. Okay. So does not intentionally replacing the native-born population with foreigners possessing diverse perspectives and a different cultural identity constitute genocide? I think it actually meets the United Nations definition of genocide.
Well, it's completely impossible to carry out this policy without genocide. You have to get rid of the existing, culture. If you're going to be putting all, and particularly as you're putting in these new cultural elements and giving them all this power and government access, the pre-existing culture has to give way. It has to disappear. There's only so much political power to go around. And when they're talking about the great political power these guys are going to be possessing in the future, it's a zero-sum game. That means that the Europeans are basically being replaced. We're certainly being replaced in terms of political power.
You tax the native-born population to oblivion to finance these diverse groups.
Yeah,
to live on welfare. Do you have $5,000 gift cards you spend as U.S. government and other organizations, these private taxi organizations or busing services that are contracting the government to disperse these people throughout the country? That's what's happening.
Yeah, I've actually met a few people that I think are part of the bust immigration wave. Just my impression is their skills in terms of wealth creation are very low. I can only imagine them at the very beginning, kind of service level jobs, maybe after their English or whatever language skills gets a little bit better. But as they come to us, they're nothing but a economic deficit. That's it. They're going to cost money to maintain. And so the point is that there isn't any actual economic reason. fact that it's just the opposite. There has to be some kind of explanation for the economic damage that they're obviously going to do as to why they're being brought in. And, you know, the great replacement idea, and there's different ways of that expression being defined, but just in general, this can only, what else can explain, you know, bringing in all like wave after wave of by the hundreds of thousands. You know, they're going to, you know, it's one, it serves several functions. One, it stuffs the ballot box because, yes, you know, these people will need to vote Democratic and they will have to vote for the most socialistic programs because that's the only way they're going to be able to survive. But it's also, at some point, I mean, they'll have to function as, you know, I would imagine the vision is for them to function as, you know, menial workers and sex slaves because the Europeans are being genocided. I mean, if you look at our birth rates and whatnot, and particularly post-vaccine, they're not heading in the right direction. So, you know, they're thinking long-term here, but I would say, you know, they're imagining in 100 years that they've brought Central America as a socialist and controlled workforce into America. The European is gone, and you know, Judeo-Masonic ruling class will be, you know, enjoying this. It's really, in a way, kind of you know, the fulfillment of Huxley's Brave New World, where you're going to have you know, intellectual stratification. There will obviously be lots of drugs and mental control over these individuals. The people who will be brought in, you know, the Guatemalans and you know, Ethiopians, the people who are being brought in will obviously be given, you know, hormone therapy, you know, psychotropic drugs. I mean, they will start to control these people mechanically, you know, and that's what their future is going to be. This, you're looking, when you think about the Great Replacement, it's also the replacement of humanity, because they're going to, the people who are being brought in will be far less able to resist any of this than those in the, from coming from the European culture. They'll fit right into the Epsilon and Delta definitions, you know, as the oligarchs define them going, you know, into the future.
Yeah, if you notice the qualitative differences in mass, and the people coming in via illegal mass immigration, as opposed to others that came in earlier waves, you're called a racist. Even though that right. that qualitative difference is a big part of the plan. It dates back to even to, you know, the Kalergi plan, where the qualitative difference is a big part of their plan to create a sort of a dumbed down, compliant, you know, Mongol, you know, mixed race European, pan-European.
Yeah, and the thing is that, you know, people talk about the idea that this is racist, you know, to have this approach, you know, to our understanding of the immigration that's coming in. But it's just an obvious fact that when you mix these cultures, that you don't end up with a stronger one. Never happens. You always end up with the strength of the two cultures being diminished. And the particularly when it's being done in a, you know, in the zone of socialism, you're just going to end up with the U.S. inner city everywhere. I mean, the autonomous zone was pretty much you know, the future, right? I mean, mm-hmm. Think about the autonomous zone. Think of the role that drugs play in the autonomous zone. Think about the kind of slavish adherence to socialism, right? And then think about the fact that the autonomous zone is completely mentally and economically impotent. Mm-hmm. I mean, none of these people can produce anything. All they can do is just live off of whatever largesse comes to them from the host culture. And, you know, and they just think of themselves somehow, you know, like a Brave New World, you know, but this is just bizarre mythology, because the fact is, They're just creatures of a sewer, living in a sewer with a sewer as a future.
Yeah, and those who say this is a product of just people, you know, making choices, preferences, individual preference. No, it's not. This is social engineering. I mean, obviously, the federal government flying around illegal immigrants to, you know, to the interior of the country isn't the free market, nor is it the federal government contracting with busing services and other transportation services to do their deed, or the stand down at the border, well-funded NGOs and foundations that are financing this. This is all part of a plan. So it's covert, not so covert social engineering, ethnic warfare, and psychological warfare. And again, if you're not willing to acknowledge that reality, you're not going to know and be understanding what's happening to you.
Yeah, and it's interesting, isn't it? You know, the intimidation of, you know, the expression anti-Semitism and racist, you know, these terms that stop people from thinking. I mean, they are really going to need to use these terms, you know, very often and intensely over the future, because the Europeans are starting to see this, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, just in general, I think, you know, certainly the independent media is aware of it. Certainly this is the information that people are talking about. And so, you know, you can see that there is a war that's going to have to get waged here, because there's no way to keep the independent media communicating to the public during a time when the public is being genocided and replaced. You know, it's, so that's why, you know, kind of all ties together, doesn't, you know, the 1-6, Gonzalo Lira, you know, these things are, you know, they're just units of propaganda that are just, I think, are going to come out faster and faster as the replacement, you know, goes forward, because you're really going to have to keep the culture that's being replaced intimidated and impotent, you know, to avoid just absolute civil unrest.
Civil unrest. A couple of weeks ago, we heard reports of riots and arrests taking place in the Orthodox Jewish community of Crown Heights. This stemmed from the closure of secret tunnels found underneath the world headquarters of the Chabad Lubavitch movement, a very strange organization. It's a subgroup of Orthodox or Hasidic Jews, very secretive and yet very powerful organization. We can talk about that. According to the reports, the riots began after police officers with the NYPD were called in response to a group of Orthodox, quote, students sabotaging an attempt to fill in a series of secret hand-dug tunnels with concrete located underneath the infamous Chabad Lubavitch World Headquarters at 770 Eastern Park Parkway. It's the world headquarters. Social media, multiple videos were circulated that depicted, literally I saw one where this guy, Jew, crawls out of a grave.
Yeah, I know. That was really
cool. I mean, runs away. Right. I mean,
obviously guilty of something. Yes. And not wanting to be seen. He crawls out of the sewer grate, just like a rat.
Talk about playing to stereotypes, and this is something out of, you'd see maybe Disturmer magazine.
You'd see something like that, like the worst kind of propaganda, anti-Semitic propaganda. Yes. It was almost like it was something out of a theater, but I'm pretty sure that was real, because, well, for one, all the, you know, surrounding information, but also the way the individual behaved. I just don't think you could be that guilty and that frightened if you were an actor. You know, he just crawled out, saw the people around him, and then just took off, you know, trying to run for freedom, basically.
Yeah, apparently it was an attempt. The organization blamed renegade students, but it doesn't seem to quite make sense, because they were looking to expand the building there, but they were doing it illegally, of course. Apparently, a lot of these Chabad members are like Israelis that are flown into the country, so it's these foreigners operating within the country. It's late Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson was once blessed by Benjamin Netanyahu, and asked them to hasten the arrival of the Messiah to defeat regional enemies and combat. Now, it's interesting, because, again, we're told this is a sort of a renegade or subgroup. But then again, it's meeting with the prime minister of Israel, getting and giving him his blessing. According to reports, the tunnels were originally discovered by a construction crew back in December under a mikveh, which is a Jewish cleansing bath. When serious concerns were raised over the structural stability, literally, I think, understand they're undermining other buildings. So there's quite a liability here. In a statement, the chairman of Chabad Lubavitch headquarters, Rabbi Yehuda Krinsky, called the actions of the tunnel diggers odious and thanked the NYPD for arresting those who tied to the vandalism. But I don't see how this was like done secretly without him knowing about it. Doesn't seem to make sense.
Right.
You know, again, why does an organization like this exist in the United States?
Right.
Allowed to exist.
Well, the tunnels, there's a lot of sort of facts and pixelated, mm-hmm. realities that are coming out from it. You don't know what's real and what's not, but there have been a lot of videos of the tunnels themselves, right? Mm-hmm. That have come out. Like the one where the rat kind of character comes out of the sewer. But the thing is completely inexplicable. And as I have said many times, in our world where the media is controlled, you have to try to use the element of what is inexplicable as the basis for thinking, right? You have to try to come up with some sort of rationale that actually does make sense and is logical. May not be truth, but at least you'll have logic in your mind rather than the inexplicable and contradictory things like this tunnel thing. The main thing with the tunnel is that the basic claim is that the tunnel diggers had the mandate to expand the synagogue. They were going to try to make it physically bigger by connecting to a mikvah, this ritual bath, and some other area. Well, this is, of course, just incoherent because this would be unique in the history of of like the Jewish religion. They don't expand like moles, they actually typically work above ground, so this is inexplicable. But the thing that was really kind of a question mark is the tunnels themselves. One of the claims is that they were going to create this access to the mikveh. Well, if you know about Jewish mikvehs, you know that there is this very high degree of cleanliness and purity, right? That is mm-hmm. associated with them. You have everything being neat and clean, and if you look at the tunnels, the videos of them, assuming that they're real, they were the filthiest thing you've ever seen in your life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these things wouldn't make it as a hallway in Animal House. They were just disgusting. There was just food and all kinds of things lying around, no order whatsoever. And then even worse, there were mattresses that they brought out.
Yeah, and like a high chair for a kid or something.
Yeah, well, I heard about that. I didn't see it, but they evidently there was, according to the rumors, that there were elements that seemed to be for young people, children. But I saw the videos of the a series of mattresses that were brought out, and these were not like queen beds. They were basically, tiny mattresses that a child might sleep on, and so this wouldn't be something that would be used by the tunnel dwelling mikveh goers, right? I mean, they wouldn't be having campouts underneath, the building, and so the whole explanation is incoherent, it's inexplicable. And of course, the independent media suggested others, and the one that was most common, I think, if you look through the internet, is that there was like the suggestion is that these could have been areas where there was child trafficking going on.
Yeah, that's been the accusation. Now, specifically to this particular story, there's no evidence for that. That's
right.
But there have been accusations going back decades regarding Chabad Lubavitch and in Crown Heights. It's been referred to as a child rape assembly line. And there have been whistleblowers, even Jews themselves in the community, that have come out and said that, it's rampant, and it goes, and pretty much the police just don't, and the authorities don't investigate it. And so it's part of the subculture.
Right. And given all of the, this kind of smoke of child trafficking that has historically swirled around Chabad, given that the tunnels would have child trafficking as a coherent interpretation of its existence, you think they would, if this was actually, you know, a world of, that had democratic principles, that there would be some really intense investigation, some forensic investigation would take place.
Well, the problem is that community, they actually have a private police force, the Borough Park Shamrim,
yeah,
which actually has police powers, effectively police powers. And so the NYPD just lays off.
Yeah, you know, I have driven through Brooklyn, Crown Heights, you know, the area that they are. If you go to the airport, you actually take a road, or if you're going to, what is it, JFK, from, like, you know, the other parts of Brooklyn, you would drive right past it. And I have driven past it. And on the Sabbath, and they have a row of police cars between, you know, the public space and the road and where you have the you know, the Jewish community. Mm-hmm. So it really is, it is like a private world that has a military that is defending it, and the military is this police force you're talking about. So the idea that the tunnels would be scrutinized carefully, in my opinion, is just absolutely far-fetched. I think that whatever went on there is going to remain a secret, and will, of course, add to the smoke around Chabad, that it's an organization that some people believe is engaged in trafficking. Nothing's going to happen out of this, and nothing will come of it. I think it's already kind of out of the news, and people will be forgetting about it shortly.
Well, good example. I think Alan Dershowitz is a member of Chabad.
And yeah.
So is the Kushners, the in-laws to Trump. They've given hundreds of thousands of dollars to Chabad. Its organization is to recruit people who don't dress funny, who represent them, who are very high up in government. And there was, this is a general problem of Jews, at least the general one we have, that the host societies have with Jews in general, is that they operate in the open, but really pursue their narrow interests. And if they, you do have people who are members of this organization that are going higher, who have links to or ties to government officials or even the government itself, it is a problem. It is, because this society, this organization has been linked to Mossad and Jewish organized crime, human trafficking, drug trafficking, ecstasy, the drug trade, money laundering. And they, if they can ward themselves off and segregate themselves and tell police and prosecutors to back off, it becomes an excellent opportunity for such illegal activity, not just child trafficking, but that too. And again, there are accusations of this. So this type of community, secret society, if you will, a secretive society within the host society, lends itself to these conspiracy theories, some valid, some more than valid than others. And so, again, what do you expect? And it does become a problem, because you have with Jews in general, but particularly this, you have another example of a state acting within a state without any effective accountability or sunlight.
Right. And with Chabad, given its incredible political access, I mean, it has connections into every element of the U.S. government and many European governments as well. In fact, I would say all of them. But the thing that really needs to be sort of brought to sunlight is to what extent its philosophies are then being applied politically. Because if you actually know about, Chabad's, some of their positions, it's completely racial. It's the most racially oriented religion imaginable. And it's also nihilistic. In other words, they have principles which basically say that sinners are not to be punished, and that it's ambivalent as to whether or not it is even possible to sin against Gentiles. Because to the extent that the kind of contrast between, you know, the Chabad community members and Gentiles is presented, it's basically like the Dead Sea Scrolls, wherein there is kind of a subhuman nature to the Gentiles that's being characterized. And the, you know, and again, the language, and of course, you know, when you say Chabad, what are you really talking about? It's not like it's an organized dictionary. I mean, you've got dozens of different philosophers that have appeared and messianic ideas and things. So it's almost impossible to pin down, but within it, it does have, well, first of all, just a, you know, kind of a strange and incoherent metaphysical and mystical belief about the world, which
just Kabbalism, right?
Yeah, you'd think that, like, well, maybe, you know, like a political person would want a little more clarity than some of these statements.
Maybe this explains U.S. foreign policy.
Well, unfortunately, it does. But the main thing is that you know, that does concern me, is that it is so basically fundamental to the kind of Judaism that would be found in the Dead Sea Scrolls, which you have to remember organizes itself around what's called the War Scroll, which is an envision of the future in which the Gentiles are exterminated, that you have this final apocalyptic battle and the Gentiles go away, ended. And so this really isn't, I think, a healthy political position to be promoting. And so that's why I would think that it would be useful, you know, to have like the Chabad members, because as you say, there are actually Chabad members in political and economic powerful positions, but also all the people who are influenced by them. My God, the list of people that are connected to Chabad is basically, I mean, the entire power structure of both political parties. Mm-hmm. This should be really open for some scrutiny. I think that the mysticism that Chabad has is one of the ways that it keeps its real intent hidden. You know, there's so much, you know, you have the cabal, you've got all of these mystical ideas, you know, ideas which, you know, kind of sort of, maybe if like you were smoking marijuana, you know, it would make sense, but are not really very coherent. But I think in total, they just form a kind of a veil of mysticism around the organization, you know, which, you know, the public looks in and you see these expressions about Kabbalah and, you know, they talk about the rational mysticism, expressions like this, none of which make any sense, you know, or just totally incoherent, but they stop people from thinking. It's the same way that I maintain the Theosophical Society set up, you know, kind of the kind of paganism that protected the development of the Nazi Party, where you have just enough mysticism that the public can't really look in a coherent way inside to see, well, what's the ultimate goal of all of this, you know? So, you know, that's my opinion about that historical event. But here, I think it's pretty straightforward. And I think in Freemasonry, it's also straightforward, where the mysticism just forms a mental barrier so the public can't see in. So this is what I would say about Chabad. It's very chilling to look inside the thing and see some of the racial and, you know, kind of, in my opinion, genocidal philosophy that's inside the thing. And it shouldn't be an organization. It should not be a secret society that has influence on our political class.
No doubt it has political influence on our political class because of the connections. That's not even in dispute. Yeah. And if you do look deeper into the Jewish, into the Jewish community, Jewish practice, it's not so much a religion, it's just it's a series of rituals and, you know, rabbinical magic, these things that don't really, as you said, don't really make much sense. Now, ordinarily, looking at these rituals, as eccentric as they are, we might look at it as, you know, eccentric and interesting, something a carryover from ancient times, not much significance to our current day, at least politically or culturally. But there is a darker side to this, as you alluded to, and primarily this involves the how Jews relate to non-Jews, the goyim, if you will.
And exactly.
If you really look at it, the Talmud, these are Talmudists, and the Talmud takes a very derogatory approach towards non-Jews. Jews have, you know, basically it states that Jews have a divine soul. The goyim, Gentiles, do not. And that indeed that the goyim, relative to Jews, are beasts in the shape of men, and they're there to serve the Jews. This is what it says. And these people believe this, apparently. And you can see in their actions, apparently like digging a tunnel, like even so much as getting a permit, thinking they can just do it because they're Jews. That's their attitude. And so you have some very influential high-ranking rabbis who have stated this. I think it was Israel's top Sephardic rabbi used his weekly sermon to declare that the only reason for the existence of non-Jews is to serve Jews and do work for them. Basically, they're to be enslaved or exterminated by Jews. This is what they said. This is Israel's top Sephardic Jew. According to them, Jews have infinite value and non-Jews have none at all, which obviously has policy implications, especially if Jews are inveigle themselves or able to worm their way in the governmental positions, achieve cultural, economic, financial, domination of a society. These things simply have to become more relevant, if you will.
I was just going to say, like Dershowitz, who people think of as this kind of rationalist, right? You know,
liberal. Cynical. He's a liberal, right?
Liberal guy, but a rationalist. He's an attorney. He comes on TV and he makes points of logic. But you have to remember, he stated that like Chabad's presence on college campuses is absolutely crucial, and no one can rest until Chabad is on every major college campus in the world. He actually made that.
Really?
Yeah. So
and then, at the same time, he says that you shouldn't be able to criticize Israel on college campus.
Right.
Or boycott them.
So, yeah. Well, there you go. But, you know, the thing is that the question is, well, why? What is being promoted here? Because if you look at the public veneer of Chabad, it's just a lump of incoherent mysticism. There's not one principle that makes any sense whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Why would it be necessary to put it on every major college? What is it doing? You know, what is the purpose of this? And you know, when I read like Dershowitz's claim, you know, I always there's so much smoke and they're able to hide behind interpretations of Hebrew. You know, if you look at certain ways that like Talmudic quotes are, you know, they will say, well, this looks like it's very anti-Gentile, and then they'll say, well, it's because you don't understand. There's a nuance to the Hebrew, and it's, you know, they take you into some kind of metaphysical place. But the fact is that Deuteronomy talks flat out about the extermination of the ethnicities, just absolutely flat out states it. And it also states, like in Isaiah, that you're going to have an apocalypse after which the Gentile goes away. And it talks about the process in Isaiah in which there's a kind of mysticism that the Gentile will, you know, like in a dream, will think he's eating and drinking, but then up suddenly and be hungry and dying of thirst. I mean, these specific and clear kind of genocidal promotions, right, that are inside the core text of the religion have to be exposed and discussed.
Well, to what extent do they influence non-Chabad members? I mean, do these ideas radiate?
Well, they're not even talked about. So I'm just saying, if you're going to bring Chabad onto the major college campus, then let's talk about the Torah. Let's talk about the racism and the genocide inside the text. And let's ask the question, is it embedded inside the organization?
Well, why should this mystical, rabbinical, magical society have presence on Western college campuses?
There's absolutely no reason. It's just fascinating because, you know, like I've written about the first century quite a bit, you know, and
yeah,
If you look at the first century, you have the Dead Sea Scroll group, right? And this, I think, is the literature of the movement that Rome was fighting against, and this is a movement that I think descended from the Maccabees, right? And Judas Maccabee was, you know, someone leading a charge against basically the secularization of Jews, right? You had this after the Seleucids, you know, like took over the region, you got Greek culture. And Greek culture was winning out over the fundamental mm-hmm. Jewish culture, right? It was the culture that was promoting not just sensuality, but also logic. This was, you know, in the rational world. The Maccabees, they did not like this. They were eventually defeated, but the Dead Sea Scroll community then took up, you know, and there was war after war against the Romans until the Bar Kokhba thing in 133, where you had the diaspora, the Jews were kicked out. Mm-hmm. But what you were looking at is kind of the same thing that you see with Chabad. Chabad is bringing in, as it presents itself, just the complete kind of, you know, accepting of metaphysical ideas that are being given to you by religious leaders who are Jewish. And they are obviously in opposition to the whole Socratic tradition that should be the promoted by our major college campuses of like, well, let's have logic and reason and, you know, analysis of and skepticism. Right. So they're completely in opposition to one another. What is it? What the college campuses should be giving to the students is exactly what Chabad is there to destroy. It's really the same thing that was going on in the first century. Where
well, it's completely. I mean, I did the university, of course, was a development of. It grew out of, you know, Greek and Roman history. Well, apparently yeah. It was a European creation. It was a Catholic Church created it. Really, I did the university, but the idea is that classical approach, which is completely contrary to the Talmudic approach, which represented right. by Chabad. So why would Chabad, who was completely adverse to the idea, to the general idea of a university, well, we see because no, you know, we see under Jewish tutelage or Jewish Jewish patrons, what universities become. They become, you know, what Ackman wants Harvard to be, which is just an organ for Zionist propaganda, more or less.
Yeah, and ultimately, well, in Zionist propaganda, which becomes, you know, a promotion of Jewish messianicism. In other yes. words, this all ends up with the Jewish Messiah ruling the world.
Even our Congress is supposed to represent the American people.
This is just the war scroll and the Dead Sea Scroll. Yeah. I mean, it's right flat right in there. The Jewish king will rule the world. Okay, so now Chabad is on every major Jewish campus, bringing its metaphysics and Kabbalah and DEI, and I mean, because you know that the political aspect of Chabad on the campuses is 100% DEI. It's mm-hmm. not going to, it's going to be, you know, obviously hunting out anti-Semitism and defining it in every way it wants, but it's going to be promoting all of the, you know, kind of anti-European aspects of our foreign policy.
Well, yeah, so here we have this community, this small little neighborhood, Crown Heights in Brooklyn, supposedly is the world center for the Chabad movement, which is very influential within the overall Jewish community and therefore very influential throughout the West, given the current dispensation, if you will, meaning we live now under an era of de facto Jewish supremacism, because you cannot criticize Jews. That creates Jewish supremacism because nothing can be really, no, their power can't be really checked, at least not in mainstream rhetoric or the electoral process or normal political process. So we have a situation where Jews, most of them have grandparents, you know, who are deeply Orthodox, who values would be very similar to Chabad Lubavitch. But nevertheless, over the centuries, you could say sort of a highly distinctive cultural pattern and culture attitudes, social attitudes would develop. And would, as I kind of alluded to, would never, no matter how liberal, you know, most Jews are, these values would seep into the wider Jewish population, especially, you know, if Yeah, if those people aren't really aware of it.
And they're given as an antidote to the Holocaust, right?
The Holocaust would be a good example.
The
Holocaust narrative is typical rabbinical strategy to maintain cohesion through identifying as victims, right? Yeah.
They sell that, and then they can sell the mysticism, which all leads basically to the Jewish Messiah.
So this speaks to the broader Jewish question that the West has been dealing with for centuries. Now, since the mid-20th century, mainstream political thought, discourse, hasn't been able to deal with it. So again, that's created a de facto situation of Jewish supremacism in the West, which now is maybe coming to its culmination, or its final denouement, if you will, however it would be resolved. But we have a situation now because of this. Basically, the Jewish question is the idea that Jews have acquired excessive cultural political influence in various host societies. This is something that for centuries, Western host societies have dealt with it in various ways, often eventually with expulsion. But as I mentioned, since the 1950s, we haven't been able to deal with it. But the Jewish question is this, is you can say maybe two or three inquiries, is do Jews possess excessive influence in their host society? Is that influence negative? And the third question is, what should be done about it? And so, again, if it's negative and it's destroying society, it has to be dealt with in one fashion or another. The fact is, because of Jewish immunity from criticism, because of the Holocaust narrative and other narratives, Jews are very good at spinning narratives. In fact, their power isn't based so much on truth, it's based on narrative. And this is why they control the organs that produce narratives, like media, entertainment, movies, news, and ultimately finance. But if you have a society, there was a time when society was aware of the Jewish question, aware of the problem of a state within a state, of an alien group with values contrary to the host society, that their influence had to be limited. But again, in our liberal societies, our postmodern, post-enlightenment liberal societies, those barriers were removed, and they've essentially have taken over. This in the United States is basically since the late 19th century. It's been a gradual process, but it's only about a century, a little more than a century. So again, the situation in Crown Heights, it's in a way it's comical, it's extreme, it's almost cartoonish, but it's real. But then if you shed some light on Chabad Lubavitch and its ties to the general overall Jewish community, and also to its connections to the political establishment of every Western country, this is a problem.
Yeah, it's a problem, and it's one that it isn't being addressed. And and the problem is the darkness, that you can never do an analysis of kind of the philosophical motivation, the economic motivation of like Chabad and other Jewish organizations. Uh-huh. And it's ironic. In fact, I had to chuckle. There is with the Gaza genocide, there's been a lot of, protests, mm-hmm. but I think also a lot of the population, I've noticed this, that is sort of thinking about kind of the idea that Israel is engaged in genocide. It's becoming something that can be discussed.
Yes.
And the response has been, one of the responses has been to
create... In fact,
it's being
litigated at the World Court, as we speak.
Yeah, as an example. Yeah. Yeah. But I don't know if you've seen it, but the they've created an organization now, and they're advertising it. It's on TV quite a bit here in California, called Shine a Light, mm-hmm. which is kind of like ironic. But it's the idea is that they want to expose anti-Semitism. Shine a light, right?
Expose it.
Yeah, expose it.
Because it's not talked about enough? Is that
right? Right, right.
Isn't there a national strategy to combat?
Yeah, I know.
Isn't there a special envoy at State Department to combat global anti-Semitism?
Tim, I'm telling you, this could be diminishing returns because yes. I don't really think that you can shine a light on any of this stuff because it can't, it always has to be hidden. And I think that at this point, these kinds of organizations, they may have been, politically powerful in the 50s, but here I think the process of, scrutiny over, kind of the the overall moral behavior, right, of these organizations, I'm afraid it's going to be hard to stop that from increasing. And I think the response that has gone on, you know, because of the Palestinian situation is just a symptom of the process that we're in, where more and more people are saying, wait a second, who are these people? They don't seem to be, you know, these kinds of the friendly, smiling people who talk about, you know, American interests, you know, Billy Crystal or you know, not Billy Crystal, but William Crystal, you know, the neocon guy. You know, you have the smiling face and all of this, but I just think people are seeing past that now, honestly. And I think that this shine a light thing is going to be interesting to see if it's effective, you know, in terms of mind control. But I think it's actually just going to be part of the unraveling. I think people are going to look at this and go, you know something? The reason they have to do this is to keep us from looking into this. This is why they're doing it. They're not doing this to shine a light on anything. They're doing this to turn a light off.
Mm-hmm. Well, another thing is kind of you mentioned earlier is this accusations of sexual trafficking and abuse within the community. Again, there are I think decades these accusations have been made within from people from the community, and it's been shut down because you're excluded from the community. And once you're excluded from the community, you have no means of support. So very few people are willing to speak up about it. In the past there have been other accusations. A good example was the so-called blood libel,
yeah,
where Passover blood was purchased. Now apparently that did happen, meaning that some Jews would purchase the blood of Gentiles to include in their Passover bread. And then there was also the accusation that some Jews would kidnap Christian children and sacrifice them and use the blood. I think it was that guy named Toaff who wrote a book about it called Blood Sacrifice. Ariel Toaff, who's a professor of Jewish Renaissance and Medieval Studies at Bar Ilan University near Tel Aviv, wrote a book about it. And he was the son of the chief rabbi of Rome, and he wrote a book about this. And this was the scandal. And this wasn't saying that all Jews were involved. It said that there was a certain subgroup of extreme Jews, or Hasidic or Orthodox Jews, that were doing this in Europe. And there were trials being held. And so now the ADL, and they said this is an anti-Semitic trope. It didn't happen. The evidence suggests that it did happen from time to time. And typical of the Jewish community, instead of owning up to it and dealing with it, they cover it up and just say this is just a lie. Same thing they dealt with, like with Leo Frank. Instead of holding Leo Frank accountable, they closed ranks, they circled the wagons, and then denied that they're guilty of anything, which just exasperates the problem. But the idea was, again, and also the idea of sexual abuse. Well, okay, now any insular community, strange sexual practice, and these rabbis, I tend to buy it that it's happening. In fact, the amount of abuse of rabbis per capita, I think, is 180 times more likely than it is for Catholic priests. Yet Hollywood has yet to make a movie about sexual abusing rabbis, abuse of rabbis. There's no Academy Award winning movie about sexual abuse by rabbis. But the general question is that we whether this is not this is occurring or what frequency it's occurring within Chabad Lubavitch or other Hasidic Orthodox communities is the overall influence of the culture by Jews in general. I mean, like, is the promoting of sexual degeneracy by Hollywood and the media, by Jewish organizations, the advocacy of gay rights and gay marriage and degeneracy and feminism by the Jews. The Jews have spearheaded all these degenerate destructive causes. So what extent they're guilty of committing sexual abuse within some of these, secluded secret societies or insular communities, the record is well known that Jews in general are responsible for promoting degeneracy, which is leading to destruction and the atomization and the dissolution of the West. And they proudly promote things. In fact, it was just last spring that the American Jewish Committee produced a video where you have this Jewish gal proudly proclaiming that Jews have always supported gay rights and gay marriage and feminism and abortion and, you know, homosexuality, these things. And of course, the promotion of these doctrines and these ideas in the youngest of children. You can now go to a middle school, elementary school library and find books promoting things like sodomy to children, homosexual sodomy to children. You can see the books, the graphic art, and it's like a child's book. And in the drag queen story hour is spearheaded by Jewish organizations. The promoting of transgenderism with children, the funding of the mutilation that they call gender affirming care, the funding, the research of gender affirming care has been spearheaded by, you know, families like the Pritzkers, these Jewish oligarchs, and other Jewish foundations. So that is clear.
I would love to know the percentages of like the Jewish population on a whole in terms of things like grooming of children for, transgender operations and things like this. I doubt if it's actually a lot different than European in the general population. Maybe 10% more would be giving into it. But I think that the oligarch class, you can see are very different in their, you know, if that assertion is true, than Jews in general. You know, they are, and of course, how do you really, you know, characterize? Because they're kind of like, as an ethnicity, they're sort of like a secret society, very hard to look inside them and know, you know, what they're like. As the expression goes, I've got lots of Jewish friends. I don't see this inside them. They seem to be kind of more moderate, humanist, secular. They're they like Hollywood movies, which is not, doesn't speak well of them. But in other areas, they're certainly no more degenerate than like the European families that, you know, are around me.
Yeah, but the organizations like the ADL.
Exactly.
The organizations, the major Jewish organizations are all behind it, lockstep.
Right. And they do not oppose it. That's one thing that I'm always interested in, is even if they are.
They never oppose it. You're right.
They have this kind of slavish connection. They feel that they need to promote these extreme organizations and extreme political leaders because they have to make sure the Holocaust doesn't occur again. They are, I've said this many times, the Jews are actually more mind controlled than the Europeans.
Yeah. Well, that happened this is illustrated a couple of years ago when a lady rabbi, a Jew in St. Louis, organized a protest of Louis the Ninth statue.
Yeah.
Named at St. Louis. And she set up a bunch of black Muslims to protest it, tear it down. It turns out, she's the one that organized it, and E. Michael Jones did some research on it, and then he called up some local Jews and said, "Hey, why is she doing this?" Well, the response from the local Jews was, "Well, she's a nut, she's a radical, no one supports her." He says, "Well, then come out and criticize her." And they said, "Oh, we can't because she's Jewish."
Right, and that's so important.
And by the way, the motivation behind the protest was that Louis IX had ordered the burning of the Talmud in the 13th century.
Right. That's really
the Talmud, by the way,
problem we've got to solve right now. You know, so the thing is that this actually is one of the reasons I have hope, is that if the independent media can break down that plank of irrationality, wherein like normal non-satanic Jews, the majority of them, can see that they're being manipulated, then they could actually turn the tables very quickly on their leaders, because, well, they have physical access to them. I've said this about Israel too. I think that Israel, you know, has, of course, on top, just the most fundamental, and basically they're like the Dead Sea Scroll organization, right? They may wear suits, but in fact they are, you know, the Netanyahu and Menachem Begin and these people are absolutely fundamental and are genocidal. They're kind of like the Isaiah idea of, like, you know, fooling the Gentiles and then getting them off the planet.
Well, I think originally Israel's demographics changes because what happens, you have the high birth rates among the Orthodox community, and the liberal Jews have very low birth rates, and they're becoming more, as represented in the current government, the coalition government, spirited by Likud. The country was founded by a bunch of Polish communists. You know,
well, they were in the first tranche of,
yes,
the country was founded by the British Freemason class, you know, that's where the State of Israel comes from. The immigration was
controlled. Out of Russia, right? It was out of Russia.
Yeah, well, they had
the way, which is, I think, isn't that the original base of Chabad Lubavitch was the Pale area, wasn't it?
That's right. And yeah. The whole Hitlerian immigration wave, you know, where Hitler was sending in all these like hundreds of thousands of Jews was
went to New York. I think they went to New York during World War II. Just before.
Well, there was some that went directly.
Or just after it or something like
that. It was after, but there was a lot that went directly before World War II. A huge, you know, like, I don't know, it was like 70, 80,000 were financed by the Nazis to leave Germany and go down there and settle.
Oh yeah, as part of the transfer agreement.
Yeah, part of the transfer agreement. So that tranche, I think, you know, you had a lot of you know, kind of idealistic, you know, kibbutz. You know, they're very influenced by, you know, like the socialist ideas and stuff. That group is kind of put out to the public as, well, look, this is what Israel is. We're this multicultural. I mean, the rave festival that the Hamas, you know, hang gliders attacked, you know, would be an example, you know, like this is kind of who we really are. I mean, that has nothing to do with the political power in Israel. That read the war scroll and you'll find out what these guys are like, you know.
But well, originally, wasn't the idea also to turn them into like farmers and being self-supportive? You know, eventually they just resorted back to international finance and piracy.
Yeah, funny how that happens. You know,
revert to the mean.
if someone wants to do a fun research, I mean, look at the surveys they did. The Masons, the British Royal Family, and the Freemasons, and this was the only funding group, and the Rothschild family. Those three groups funded a whole series of surveys. Right, I've talked about it before. These surveys that were part of the proto-Zionism. This is before Herzl, you know, so this would be like 1850, 1860. Charles Warren, you know, the guy who botched supposedly the Jack the Ripper case. He was one of the guys they sent there. They sent guy after guy, survey after survey. What were they doing? They were looking for the areas of Palestine that they needed to steal first so they could put in farmers to create like a food production. This was actually what that was all about. And so the first tranche, what, you know, they talk about these farmers and the kibbutz and the socialist ideas. That was what the public was being given. But in back of it was the, you know, genocidal vision that, you know, the proto-Zionists like Churchill and Palmerston and these guys had when they were trying to set up and they were going about the business setting up Israel. So there's always the two things, you know, you always have the public persona of Judaism, of Freemasonry, of the secret societies. It's charitable, it's multiculturalism. Man, you don't have to look very far inside the thing to see that, wait a second, actually the power here is all genocidal.
Yep.
You know, you just have to do enough analysis to see it.
Well, it's Ron Unz says, per capita, the Jews have been the most genocidal people in history.
He's right, of course. I mean, I don't know. Yeah, maybe the Romans would be, per capita, yeah, no, that's true. Very, very possible because they had such leverage. You know,
but then again, their history, the official history is they're the only real victims. The biggest victims. I mean, they're actually the biggest perpetrators.
They never do anything bad.
Well, that's the importance of narrative control. Again, it's not truth, it's narrative.
Right.
That's, we live on narratives, unfortunately.
We do. And even the fact that now the public is being made aware of the idea of narrative ultimately will end this trick that's being played against us. It's just a question of, can they genocide and control us by chemicals and things and wreck our minds and our children faster than we can wake up to the idea of the narrative control? Because both processes are in motion right now in full throttle, really. So the future is going to be very interesting, you know, to use an expression.
So, okay, Joe.
Tim, thanks for the discussion, and we'll talk next week, brother.
Enjoy the week. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.